Thank you for standing by, and welcome to this Record Abstraction Process conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. Now, at this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Terry Straub. Ms. Straub, please go ahead.
Thank you, Dwayne. Good morning to all of you, and thank you for joining us again this week. We had a lot of positive feedback from last week's teleconference call, where we had Nancy Foster from AHA and Jason Goldwater from CMS speak about what their initiatives are and their processes, and I hope you all found that helpful. Again, if you have any questions related to last week's call, Jason was more than gracious to offer us his email and to become more interactive with the hospitals moving forward. So I think that was a very positive outcome of that first call. Today we're fortunate to have with us Regina Berman, the Director of Performance Improvement at Hackensack University Medical Center. And we invited Regina to speak on the call because when we reviewed the national data, we found that Hackensack had good performance results as well as good validation results. In addition, they had good data that they had compiled on the exact time for abstraction, and they had some different interesting processes for doing medical record abstractions. And as you will be able to tell when Regina speaks, you'll see that their program has evolved from the sixth scope of work, now entering into the eighth scope of work, as the measures have changed and as they have identified additional best practices for the data collection process. Just to be aware, there is no right or wrong in the data collection process, and every hospital will have to determine their own process based on their own culture and staffing resources that you have available. But by the end of the sessions on September 27th, I think hospitals will have a good sense that there are different alternatives, and we may want to, as a group, explore some common training sessions and some additional sharing of practices or sharing of resources to get this job done in an effective and efficacious way that we get good data results both on performance and on the validation results. So that said, I'd love to turn it over to Regina, and again, thank you all for joining us. And Regina, thank you for agreeing to share your information with all of the hospitals throughout the New York State and New Jersey area within our membership. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Terry. For those of you who are on the call, we did send out a document that Terry went out to the emails, right?
Yes, it did. And if you did not receive the document, it was only sent out this morning, and you have access to a computer now, email Casey, C-A-S-E-Y, at gnyha.org, and she will immediately send out the document to you.
Right, and we sort of call this the fish tanks or something, or the water tanks, because it is not an easy visual, but I thought it would be helpful for those of you who do have access to it, and we will send it out to anyone who doesn't, just to walk through some of the concepts. But first, before we get into that type of detail, what I'd like to do is just tell you a little bit about the journey, because I think this has been a work in progress. We are fortunate enough to have very good results. We are part of the CMS demonstration project, and we are top decile in all categories right now, which is really quite good. And we've gone through a lot of learning to get there, and it's not all been fun, as you know. With the sixth scope of work, I'm sure you all remember, we had to look at a sample of Medicare patients, and so that was a relatively manageable workload. And the approach we took here, we had a very formidable APN group. We have a large number of APNs in the institution. And so we started to combine some ideas of disease case management with the abstraction, sort of to get a best practice approach built in. And so the APNs were directly involved with the data abstraction, although remembering that in the sixth scope of work, it was a much more simplified process. I think the inclusions and exclusions were relatively clear. They resonated relatively easily with the clinical staff. I think there was a bit of less controversy than there is today. And so it was a smooth transition. And as long as we were doing a percent of Medicare, it was 15 or so patients per APN per week to meet our quotas. It went very well. And the focus of their work and the premise was that we wanted someone who could intervene in patient care. And since they have collaborative practice agreements, we could, and they're licensed to write orders that if there were deficits, they could immediately intervene. So the concept was not just one of study, but it was one of intervention and activity. It worked incredibly well. We put together four expert teams, which at the time included stroke, because stroke was in the sixth scope of work, and we really had those multidisciplinary teams guide the design of the programs and then review every variances and the causative factors of the variances, and together they decided what the next steps were. It wound up building, programmatically building a lot of understanding and communication across the systems. We learned early on, because that was in the 99 range, 99-2000, we learned early on about transitions in care and how that tended to be when you failed. And so it was a nice model. When the data components started to increase, what the APNs found is they were doing less intervention and more data management, and we found that that was not why we had this skill set involved. And so we pulled the data management back from the APNs and did, at the time, the vendors, you know, were stepping up and the core measures were growing. So we decided to go retrospectively and have the medical record staff or the health information management staff, a certain subsection of those staff, be involved in doing the actual chart abstraction into the web-based system to transmit our data both to JCO and to CMS, or the local pros, and start to have the APNs focus solely on intervention, case finding and intervention. Large barriers were, and I think this will probably resonate with most of you, large barriers were admitting diagnosis. You know, often patients were admitted with a list of symptoms as opposed to a diagnosis. So sorting out who was a heart failure and who was a pneumonia and who was a what became a very complex story. So what we found is that those patients who wound up in a clustered area were very easy to manage, and the staff, first-line staff, became quite expert at understanding not only the diagnosis but the operational process and outcome measures that were important, and they geared up very, very quickly and very successfully. Those patients that wound up in the mixed med-surg units, like a pneumonia patient or a heart failure patient, as opposed to an AMI patient who went to a clustered unit, we had many more barriers and challenges, mostly related not to the care that was provided but to the case-finding part of it. And we did all sorts of IT things to try to get a working list into the hands of the disease-specific nurse APN. And that is still an unresolved issue. We've gotten a whole lot better about it. Most of our patients come in through the ER, and I think we have a very, very high census. We're always up in the high 90s. So many of you may have the same experience, and we had to work very closely with the ETD to make sure that they are actually assigning and admitting diagnosis. Still a challenge, still hard sometimes, but we've reduced that aspect considerably. So we moved on, and what we found is, you probably have also come up against this barrier, what we found is when the coding staff were doing the abstraction, the type of documentation that is compliant with the coding rules is not necessarily the type of documentation the average practitioner provides. And I'm sure some people are chuckling at that. But there was a fair discrepancy between documentation and coding. So we did have to start a big initiative on that relative to those things that met inclusion and exclusion criteria. And it was interesting because what we did find, the favorable part of the story, is that the clinical care was quite appropriate. But the numbers were not necessarily always showing it because of documentation deficiencies, mostly related to either discharge education components and or exclusion, meaning exclusionary criteria. The physicians very often felt that a lab report would speak for itself and so therefore would not necessarily document in the progress notes that the patient has a creatinine level of X and therefore is excluded from the use of an ACE or an ARB. I think, unfortunately for us all, as we went through the seventh scope of work and some of the changes in the seventh scope of work, and some of the new algorithms, some of those issues have become even more prominent instead of less. And I'd like to tell you that we have been included in some roundtable discussions with CMS on exactly those issues, and I'll get to that a little bit later. But major barrier. So we set forth quite an initiative on assuring documentation and coding. Part of the process, we have our MDR rounds. And what we were hoping to do as we moved the operational component of the data abstraction and entry into the computers and across the systems to the HIM staff, we really expected the clinical staff to spend more of their time assuring right care, right time, and discussing any deficits in the MDR rounds, which happened daily on all of the adult units, and I believe now pediatrics, but initially adults. At that point in time, we also had been the recipient of the Pursuing Perfection Grant, one of seven hospitals, and a lot of the work that we had done was the foundation work for the grant. And the concept we adopted was to really not only look at compliance, but to look at defect-free care. And we moved into a model of not just examining variances, although we continued to do that, but we started to create our reports for the teams and for senior leadership in a composite. And the composite basically gets to the all or none. While we might have had 90% compliance in each indicator, we started looking at how many patients received everything all the time correctly, which is an all or none measure. And what you found is when you had your individual indicators in the 90s, when you got into a composite score, it could be down in the 60s. Because maybe Mary Jones didn't get her ACE and Tom Smith didn't get his ARB and someone else didn't get their discharge aspirin. But when you put it together, only 60% of the patients got everything they were supposed to get during that stay. So that was quite a wake-up call and a challenge because we were feeling real good about ourselves. The sixth scope of work, we were probably two standard deviations ahead of everyone else in the state when we first started. I'm sorry, I don't know how to discontinue that, but we were very high. We started high and we continued high, but then we challenged ourselves. We challenged ourselves to say, okay, how many patients really received perfect care? It was quite a wake-up call. And so we shifted gears again, trying to say, if they're not getting perfect care, what are the barriers? Continued along some of those same aspects I told you about, which was the admitting diagnosis component, and some of them were time frames. So we spent a lot of time doing process flows and looking at time frames and looking at some of those pieces, which is more about the improvement side of this than the abstraction side, but I thought I would point that out because I think one of the reasons we continue to have high grades now across all case types is because we really did do some process redesign. So we started with redesigning and designing and redesigning the process for data abstraction, but we didn't end there. We really got into the nuts and bolts of different segments of care throughout the organization and trying to understand the transitions. That work helped us not only meet our numbers, but in general to really improve efficiency and other components, that, and I think satisfaction, because the appearance as the patient moved through the system really was more of a well-oiled machine than not. So I think those are important sort of secondary effects that you get if you start to look at your information differently. Now, again, depending on how you're organized, we did have these expert teams for each of the case types, and they were very empowered to make recommendations and do tests of change constantly. They did not have to go through multiple approving bodies to try to get something done. If they found that their call system in the ETD was delayed because they were making sequential calls instead of simultaneous calls, they were empowered then and there that day to go ahead and change the process and to test it. And our test were the next five patients that came in the door. We did not do these long and protracted tests, which I think is also another important piece. If you think you're on to an improvement, you have to just test it small scale and then move on. And I think that helped us build momentum because people were happy to see that they were solving problems without much pain attached. Okay, so now we'll go back to the abstraction process. I'm going to assume by now that most of you have been able to pick up this document that we sent out. And if so, if you don't have it, I'll try to describe it in a manner that won't be too, that you can hopefully capture a visual. But we start with the first line is just outlining what the case types are. And, of course, heart failure, AMI, CAP, SIP, and then we have now added SCIP. SIP will eventually go away, but that won't happen until January of 2006. But we're gearing up for SCIP, so we've added it at this point. And then we added which project or which reporting body these metrics go to. And you'll see things like core measure, seven scope of work, HQI, AHA, which is the HQA. We have the CMS demo project, which is the HQA. Then the next line goes into population. And one of the commitments we made for pursuing perfection and toward our core measures was 100% case type review. And so heart failure is 100% population, AMI is 100% population, so is CAP. SIP remained a sample of Medicare. However, the CMS demonstration project required 100% for orthopedic and CABG cases, and so we have continued 100% for those two case types, and we've done sample for the other five, the other three, I think, vascular, colon, and deliveries, vaginal and abdominal deliveries. And then SCIP will be... is the IPG that we've been invited into, and we're projecting total population of certain case types, but not all of them. And so that is really important consideration because I do think my understanding is, although we're waiting for confirmation, that there's going to be a cap on the sample size of 504 for large institutions and then down to something reasonable like 75 for some of the smaller institutions. So we still have to wait for that. But anyway, moving through the process, the next thing we did was we looked at what our census was and what our average number of volume of case types were per month. And we have about 80 heart failures, 90 AMIs, 84 CAPs, and 130 SIP. We then worked with the HIM staff to look at some time motion studies and see how much time it actually took to get through a chart. And with a random enough sample of small charts, large charts, straightforward cases, secondary diagnoses, primary diagnoses, and we came up with an average amount of minutes and then converted them into hours per month. And based on that, we resourced the abstraction area, which really were just converted positions from prior coding and coding assurance type staff. Basically, the abstraction average is about 130 hours a month or 3.2 FTEs of work per week per month. The process, we have Premier as our vendor, and the process initially was fairly retrospective in nature, which is why we split the functions, because we had the clinical staff going back to the APNs and the MDR teams at the front line, assuring care and metrics, but delivery of the processes and the outcomes. But we really could not keep the data piece concurrent. So, and the system did not allow for that. It does now, though, and I want to just go to that a little bit. The web-based system, we had QuadraMed. We started with QuadraMed. And I think for those of you who are in New Jersey, QuadraMed was the vendor for the state, and there was daily transmittal of information from patient accounts and medical records over to QuadraMed, and so we would get a pull list on almost a daily basis that would allow for better case finding. But again, they were still post-discharge cases. but it was in a relatively close proximity. When we went to Premier, there was a more retrospective manner because they weren't getting automatic feeds from finance, and so we would be sending over our systems data to them on a periodic basis, and they would push back pull lists, which is the other reason we had to have a dedicated fixed staff to function and do this work, because it wasn't something that you can do in a concurrent manner up on the floors. Premier has now developed something called Create a Case. And so if you choose to do concurrent data abstraction up in the clinical area on a daily basis, you actually can go in and populate the patient case in the web-based system, and then add to that on a daily basis until the case is complete and discharged. So that's one option that did not exist in the past that currently does exist now. The second thing that's been created are real-time reports. When you looked at data errors, key punch errors, and other such things that are killers, when you start to get down to a small number of variances, your error reports, your data error reports, really wind up having a big impact on your numbers. And when you look at, for example, in the CMS demonstration project, 100 is the top five deciles for some of the indicators in AMI is 100. So when you're dealing with top decile performance, you don't want a lot of key punch errors or data reliability errors. So we put a lot of effort into assuring data. Premier likewise responded to that need by creating something called real-time reports, where the abstractive staff could go in on a daily basis and look at any errors and do error adjudication, whereas in the past that was done 30, 60, 90 days later, which meant a lot of rework from a resource standpoint, because you should you would have to wait for the errors to be sort of systematically organized and then fed back to you across the system. So those are some technological improvements that have made this a much more manageable scenario. And, again, because we have these expert teams in place, we needed more real-time feeding to the teams so that the teams could get about doing their work. Getting information 12 weeks after the patient's been home did absolutely nothing for improvement. It did a lot for compliance, but nothing for improvement. So I think that's why I started with talking about some of the improvement initiatives, because that truly is why we're doing this. And I think sometimes we get so bogged down in the numbers that we forget that we're trying to understand why we have variation in care. Okay, should I stop there for a minute, or continue going through the process?
Operator, we could open it up for some questions, and then we could move on to the next step of the process.
All right, and it is star one if you do have a question at this time. We'll pause just a moment. If you've been utilizing your mute button, you want to make sure that's disengaged. And we do have two so far, and we'll first go to, Judy Glesko with Saratoga Hospital.
Hi, I have a very basic question. I kind of came in right when you indicated where the handouts were. Can you give me that the email address again, please?
Sure, it's kccasey at gnyha.org.
Okay, terrific. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Now we do have a question then from Melba Tellen with Jamaica Hospital Medical Center.
Hi. My question is related to the HIM staff who you've indicated does the chart abstraction. Is that correct?
That's correct. Post-discharge.
Correct. Now, what training and background do they have?
They are, we call them clinical data abstractors, and they actually all have coding backgrounds.
Okay. And APN, again, stands for?
Advanced Practice Nurse.
Okay, so they could basically do the intervention, as you've mentioned, because they could even
they can write
orders.
They can write orders, and they are really very well-respected in the organization and can intervene rather rapidly with the attendings. We have almost an entirely voluntary medical staff. We don't have a lot of full-time faculty. And so most of the docs, as a lot of you will know, are out in their offices. They'll come in the morning, make rounds, go to their offices, and be in their offices all day long, and then make rounds in the evening. Sometimes the clock is ticking very quickly, and so the APNs have... We thought if we had a dedicated group of people that the doctors could anticipate being in touch with them, then we could foster more rapid communication. And so, and then the APNs also had the ability to write orders and follow up in a more independent manner than just some of the staff nurses. And so that worked. It really met a need for the attendings who were otherwise not available.
That's true. No, the APN, the number of APNs that you currently have,
we have a lot, and I don't even like to tell you because it's going to scare everybody. You don't need this number to do this work, but we have in the organization over 50. But
okay.
We're over 700 beds, and we have a huge ambulatory component, and a lot of those APNs are programmatically placed in programs that are primarily ambulatory.
Okay.
Those are not on the acute inpatient side. I want to say on the inpatient side, functioning in this regard, we probably have eight or ten if we included pediatrics. Okay, so that gives you the scope, but we did have in the organization that many, so then it was a matter of saying we had advanced skills, what could we do with them? So I think one of the questions is, what do you have, and what's the best way to leverage on the skill sets that you have?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, now going back to the HIM staff, you said that they do the chart abstraction. And is that all that they do? I mean, I know you mentioned 3.2 FTEs per week. Considering the volume that you have to meet this requirement, so you have full-time three people from HIM.
Yeah, we had an average of 130 hours per month or 3.2
equivalent to 3.2 FTEs.
Well, no. It was 3.2 work hours. Now, when you do the conversion to FTEs, that raises it up because you add in benefits and other such things. So the 3.2 was without the FTE equivalent.
Okay.
So you'd have to add some benefits. So it probably comes in a little over 4.
Okay.
4.5 or something like that.
Mm, very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah.
No further. Well, I take that back. And Roy Gomes with Calvary Hospital.
Yes. Could you just repeat that email address for me?
Sure. It's kccasey@gnyha.org.
Okay. Thank you much.
Welcome.
No further questions at this time.
So then why don't we, while some of you are trying to access this document, why don't I go to the next phase, which is post-abstraction. As you know, I think one of the tricky pieces here, and we have to now be thankful to Joint Commission and CMS and others who have aligned their time frames and their expectations. But remember, we had a lot of chaos with different time frames and really spent a lot of time and effort on tracking when you transmitted what to whom. Thank goodness a lot of that has gone away, and it's become much more predictable as far as having due date deadlines and crossing of reports and then receiving a comparative data back. So given that, we then made sure that we had the variances logged. Now, for those of you who still have a lot of variances in each category, the main thrust was trending those and trying to get a handle on why it was happening. Was it a system issue? Was it an individual practitioner issue? You know, what were the causative factors? Were it resource issues? Was it access to treatments or procedures? So one of the early findings, of course, is that we did not have a 7-day, 24-hour cath lab, and we still don't, but we have an on-call system now that's very, very rigorous, and our time to thrombolysis, I think we have 90% of the patients now getting thrombolysis within 75 minutes. See, we keep moving the bar. When it was 120, we went to 90. When it was 90, we went to 75. We want to always try to have an edge over what the external expectations are. But, you know, so one good example of did we have capacity was let's look at can we ever meet these time frames? Can we always meet these time frames? And I think that was one piece of the consideration. But looking at global trends, as we started to put programs in place and redesign processes, the variances became very few and far between. Some of them were as simple as patient preference, and we have to honor patient preference, and I think that's one of the rather large discussions we did have with CMS. If someone does not want to have an angioplasty because they want to see their rabbi or they want to see their loved one that they fear they may never see again, we have to honor it. And so our clinical teams basically said, you know, we're going to give appropriate care and we're going to give perfect care, even though it means our number won't be 100. And we actually went up through our medical board quality groups and up to the governing body and said that we have to have a posture of tolerating some variation that's considered appropriate, and decided that the clinical teams would be making those calls. And so, you know, some of the posture we took is when 100 is not good, because sometimes trying to get the 100 number leads you to doing things that involve overutilization and or some patient preference issues that, you know, we just feel morally and ethically is not correct. Given all of that and posturing that way, our numbers are very high. So I think we are being fairly diligent about, you know, allowing appropriate variation and yet still, you know, meeting the needs, the quality needs of the consumers and the patients that we serve. Just thought I'd add that as a proviso, because that's basically a cultural concept that has to be understood and accepted throughout the organization. And we did talk to CMS about that. We think while you need to standardize data, you need to also have some appropriate exclusions for patient preference. So the variances now, the initial step was trending and reacting definitively to those trends. We did have a monthly PDSA cycle where we did do test of change, and I think doing that, and while many in the beginning groaned about doing that, it really had us build momentum and move forward very, very quickly with our improvements and testing what did or didn't work. Very quick feedback and then very quick spread of a concept. We are now, fortunately, in the position of having very few and far between variances, and each one is looked at for causative factors. Some of them are education or training of staff. Several of them were related to change of shift and or transitions from one location to another. We still do have the, although to a much lesser extent, some of those challenges around discharge, you know, having clear documentation of the either the drugs or the education at discharge. And most of our variances in that regard is not that the activity didn't happen, but that the documentation was not explicit enough or that there was conflicting information. Our HIM staff are very rigorous about conflicting information and always err on the side of a variance as opposed to, you know, they keep us on our toes about that. But, for example, if your discharge summary process is being done by a resident who maybe did not really participate in the care of the patient and he leaves off one medication, you're going to fail on some of those metrics. So I think some of those become larger systematic issues than did this patient get right care. Yes, the care was correct, but somehow our chart is not really showing it very well. So I can't underscore enough the need for documentation and coding alignment and health information management concepts being well understood by the clinical staff. Okay, I think that's the most important part. The teams will assess, test the change. If it works, it gets adopted without much ado, unless it's something huge, like I just said, the discharge summaries. You know, we have talked about having the time frame for completion of discharge summaries shortened so that the information is more fresh in the mind. And, of course, with other medication reconciliation initiatives, I think that the two-prong approach will be very helpful. But those are longer initiatives as opposed to a team deciding who calls when. One of the things we did for the AMI group, and this was great for those of you who have a large voluntary staff, is we worked, the ETD worked very closely with the voluntary staff to understand who their preferred cardiology referrals were and who their preferred interventionalists were, so that when a patient came in the door and needed a quick intervention, we were also honoring medical staff preferences. And from a physician engagement standpoint, I do believe that that was a pivotal decision to be made, because when you're voluntary attending, you don't want to feel that your patients are being taken over or lost to some other system where they are not even aware of the patients being in the hospital, et cetera. So we made it a very strong and firm consideration that we would honor attending preferences, and they were very good about getting them in, and the ETD has all of that information available to them at the press of a button. And so sometimes what you need to do to change physician behavior is often just, you know, involve them in what their preferences are and set up a system to make it work, and the truth is it works quite well. So I just offer that to you. The variances are logged right now, or let me say not right now, prior we set up Excel spreadsheets for the variances to go to. And what we did was we sorted them by unit and indicator. So the AMI team would have, you know, their 8 indicators sorted by unit, and we, once we got the large trends handled, we would see where the those variances were occurring. And again, the HIM staff did maintain those Excel data sheets and would bring them to the meeting for the team to consider along with the chart. And so if there was a discrepancy, it would be adjudicated right then and there at the table. The other piece we built in is once the APNs got uninvolved in the data collection initiative, they were called upon to review variances before any finalization of the data. So if there was a question about an exclusion criteria, the APNs were the first call to go down and look at those variances. Again, with the numbers being so small, it's a very manageable scenario. And what it did was it would engage the HIM staff and their algorithms that they were following, the clinical view, and then any time there was a discrepancy between the APN and the HIM staff, the variance and the chart would go to the full team. And the decision would be made there. And I have to tell you, having that level of discussion really increased the learning of all, because they're, you know, the coding rules were basically unknown and unclear to the medical staff. The teams that we have are led by physicians as a physician champion on each one, and we also have a champions committee where we have the team leaders, physician champions of each one of those teams who are, you know, area experts. We have the APN and or nurse manager from the given areas, especially if they're in a clustered unit. Otherwise, we have a representative from one of the other units. And we have the HIM staff, and they come together once a month just for cross case type sharing and learning. So if one team has come up with an intervention that really seemed to work, and I think that admitting diagnosis piece would be a good example, both pneumonia and heart failure was struggling with that, then if one found a scenario that worked, they would bring it to champions meeting and we would have that sharing and learning. And I think it was very important because it tended to move everyone forward at once, and it started to shorten our learning curves and really increase our ability to intervene and move forward. The teams that are involved have become quite savvy. They're small and they're functional, and they've become quite savvy in understanding the rules here. And we have spent a relatively large amount of time with CMS and some of the expert panels talking about inclusions, exclusions, new science, and our voice has been heard. A lot of the modifications have been made that we've requested, albeit they take 6 months to a year to get done. But we have found that process to be pretty good, although lengthy. I think I don't want to bore you to tears about that. I guess maybe we should go back to some questions and answers at this point.
Yeah, operator, we can open it up for questions.
All right, very good. Again, that's star one. Pause just a moment here. And we do have a question from Judy Glusko with Saratoga Hospital.
Hi, thank you. It's been really very informational. I do have a question regarding we're on the bridge of physician engagement. And a lot of the questions seem to be focusing on the coding end rather than the documentation. So we're trying to just give them an overall review of what core measures is, what the intention is. What else could you suggest at this point in time?
Well, you know, we've done a fair amount of work with that, because what I sort of have a mantra on this end that some are tired of hearing, but basically there are coding rules and then there are clinical abstraction rules. And okay. While they're related, they are not one and the same. And so there are times, and we have worked a lot of that out at the team level, there are times when the coding rule doesn't equal the abstraction rule.
Okay.
And I do want to say this is where we have spent a fair amount of time with CMS, because what has happened, as you know, when you have an interpretation issue, we'll post a question to the QNET or the CMS group there, and often the answer you get back is not necessarily one that you would expect to get back, and sometimes we get more than one answer which are discrepant with each other on the same question, given at two different points in time or answered by two different people. So one of the things we've worked with CMS about a lot is to really make sure that the intent of the metric is the focus of the algorithm and of the, when the questions are being responded to really get down to the intent, because we do think the coding rules sometimes bump up against the intent of the abstraction rule. So that gets real tricky for docs, and the truth is they have absolutely no patience for it at all. What we do say to them is, If you don't want to give this patient an ACE or an ARB, you got to tell us why.
Okay.
Plain and pure. You know, so I think what you want to do is translate it down into the most simple terms. I heard someone present once who said you have to give them every ounce of information they need to do their job, but not one ounce more. And I think we've tried to simplify it down to what's actionable for you.
Okay.
So they don't really need to understand all of the back office systems behind it, but they need to understand if you're not going to do it, there has to be a clear and compelling reason why.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you.
Helps.
Once again, star one, and we'll next go to Barbara Siegel with Hackensack University Medical Center.
Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I don't have a question. I just want to kind of tie into what Regina said related to the coding versus the abstraction rules. Administrative data was never intended to be used for determining quality, and I think it's incumbent on all of us when we run up to these discrepancies that we do take that information back to our QIO, back to CMS. You know, it's difficult. Now, on the last call last week, a question was about admit status and, you know, whether or not it should be through the ER or should it have been from the nursing home. And whichever answer you use will make a difference in where you continue to abstract. And unfortunately, sometimes the UB92 data definitions don't quite match, as Regina said, to the clinical, you know, initiatives with the CMS project or the PRO and all these projects. So I think it's up to us to really try to understand the discrepancies and bring those issues back to the powers to be that are making the decisions on this. And again, administrative data was never intended to demonstrate quality.
Right. Good point, Barbara. And I think the other strategy that we tried to apply here is to make sure your senior leadership understands some of that, because the tendency to look for the 100 is always there. And, you know, we sometimes wonder how people actually get 100, because there are variations that are going to impact this on small levels, but it does impact it. So it's some good education just for the administrative staff as well as the clinical staff.
And there's still that opportunity for a question or comment. I'll leave that opportunity just one more moment. Star one. And we do have Lori Finkelstein with Mount Sinai, New York.
Hi, Lori.
How are you? My question really is related to some of the logistics of what you were talking about. I will say that we've actually done similar analysis here in terms of the number of extractors that would be necessary to do the kind of concurrent abstraction that you're talking about, and our numbers are, you know, like equivocal with yours based on size and time. The question I have is this going on concurrently, if I understand you correctly, and you have these, where do the abstractors sit? Are they on the units?
No. The APN MDR round stuff goes on concurrently. Initially it was all concurrently, but then it split. And the HIM staff do it retrospectively post-discharge. And I don't know if Barbara wants to comment on this, but the create a case now gives us the opportunity to do that even on the unit. We're not doing it on the unit yet. Barbara, who you just heard speak, is doing some pilot testing, starting with the group of immediate discharge, immediate post-discharge. But our interventions are expected to occur on the unit on a daily basis, not to wait for retrospective data to take action. So the unit's there for available, but they're not abstracting it on the unit yet.
And Barbara, I do have your line open.
Yes, we just started our transition from retrospective abstraction, which, as Regina said, was about a three-month delay in getting the information. We hope that transitioning to create a case is going to make the information available to those who need it to make decisions and change processes much sooner. It's a little early yet in that process because we just started a few weeks ago, and we're doing some learning ourselves along the way. We do anticipate that it is going to bring information sooner to the clinical staff, and perhaps we'll be able to better intervene when we do identify some issues more quickly.
Thank you.
And I think if I could just add to that, one of the benefits we perceive is that you get rid of your documentation and coding discrepancies, because if you know about it closer to real time, the documentation can be enhanced to reflect the actual care instead of having gaps that you cannot change retrospectively.
Yeah, one of the things that we're doing, we have, if you want to call it a pilot, on one or two units where one of my expert coders does go up in the morning and participates on the multidisciplinary rounds, and she is reviewing charts at that point in time to identify gaps in documentation. Rather than waiting till the patient's discharged and the physician looks at the chart, you know, a couple weeks after that, and we pose a question to them at that point, those questions are being posed while the patient's still here. And what we found is on that unit, we no longer have any post-discharge coding queries. So that has improved the process. And that opportunity to discuss the documentation as it impacts the abstraction for the quality has been a very good process for the clinical teams and a very good learning process.
Yeah, it's a lot of learning built in. Barbara, since you're on the line, there was a question about the skill sets of the abstraction staff. I don't know if I answered that completely.
Our coordinator is a HIM credentialed individual who has a coding expertise background. We have a part-time physician whose background is OBGYN. He's been very instrumental in helping us with the SIP project. And the other abstractors are all registered nurses with clinical background, of course, but they've come from utilization management and those type of roles, so they have familiarity with reviewing charts, you know, in the manner that we need it. So it's a good collaborative of different disciplines, bringing each part of the knowledge base together to make this work.
So, you know, one of the major problems that we have, I think, that when you're looking at the coding side by side with the clinical care of the patient and the assumption of the patient's diagnosis, you know, related to cat pneumonia, in terms of, you know, patients that come in with CHF or COPD, and to make the determination of whether it's pneumonia or it's not pneumonia, and the timing of the antibiotic. Are they making, you know, what do they do? You have to toss a coin on some cases in terms of how you want to code it. Do you have any guidelines relative to that, or how do you make that determination if it could go either way?
Well, you know, Lori, one of the things we did was with the ER, because that's where most of the patients were presenting, they have a fast-track system with radiology now where if the patient has certain complaints like the shortness of breath, fever, et cetera, if they're in a high-risk category, they get a triage quick x-ray so they can verify pneumonia very quickly. That's helped a lot. The other thing is really working with the ETD doctors to get them into the habit of writing a diagnosis as opposed to the list of symptoms. And remember, with CAP, you have to have a working diagnosis at the time of admission of pneumonia. Now, there are times when at the time of admission it was not the working diagnosis but subsequently became the working diagnosis. We've been able to sift and sort those out pretty well, but I think the fast-track x-ray has helped a lot.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Do you have a question then from Chris Somero with, is it Kaleida Health?
Kaleida, that's right.
Very good.
My question is about the 100% chart review that you're doing. We're currently doing 100% chart review. We're thinking maybe in the future going to the sample size. I was wondering what advantages you found to doing the 100% chart review, why you selected and are continuing to do that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think the reason we went to the 100% was really because of the Pursuing Perfection grant, and we were obsessed with this perfect care scenario, that we really wanted to see how many patients were getting absolutely perfect care all the time. And that's when we got into the composite scores and the all and nones and all of that, which I think, you know, just a heads up, will be something in the future when we get deeper into pay for performance that might become a reality, because it does make a difference. But I think if we had not been involved in that, we probably would have gone more to a sample, and we still may in the future go to a sample. We're locked in to the demonstration process, I think until end of year 2006 or close to the end of year in 2006, at which time we can reconsider. But I do think there was value, you know, methodologically, sample size-wise, you have enough information from a sample to extrapolate. But we really wanted to know where the variances were and why they were happening. So I think from a learning curve standpoint, it really helped us to get quicker insights into where things were breaking down. And so it served us from that standpoint to continue to do it when our numbers are very high all the time probably doesn't make sense from a resource standpoint. But I think it is a good way to really get to understand what's actually going on in your organization.
Okay, thank you.
And there appear to be no further questions at this time.
Okay, well, it seems like we're in pretty good timing. I can tell you that we are aware of organizations. We've spoken with organizations who just do a system-to-system exchange of data, and they're very comfortable with that, and they use systems like TSI and others. You know, if the patient got an aspirin on the day of admission, that's good enough. I don't know if that's going to get you where you need, but they're... You know, there are some ways that people have cut down on their direct abstraction requirements, although I can say I don't know that they have as much insights into their improvement initiatives. And so I do think you want to keep a balancing act going on. And I did want to just mention two things, maybe three, from the discussions with CMS, because I know you had some discussions with them at the last conference call. But one of the themes that came out relatively clearly was that ranking systems tend not to be the way to go. And for some of these new pay-for-performance initiatives that Congress is looking at and others, we're looking more toward thresholds as opposed to these ranking systems, which tend to just get people hysterical. And they confuse the public. They confuse the public. We did ask that the interpretive guidelines be more explicit relative to the intent of the metric as opposed to, you know, a lot of the noise around the metric, and that we include patient preference. I think the last piece that was very important was the validation process. We have been very fortunate that our validation is very high. You know, we've scored well consistently, and we're very pleased about that, so we think the time and effort has been well spent. We have some colleagues that are very, very high performers who have done terribly on their validation, and a lot of it goes back to the documentation issue and the consistency of documentation. So I don't think enough can be done to help with that. And some of the things Barbara described, I think, are very very good initiatives to try to work out and keep it as simple as possible for your medical staff, because they are not here to learn the ins and outs of coding. They're really not here to learn all of that. So you want to give them what they need to do so they can be appropriately actionable. And that's my swan song.
Thank you so much, Regina. This has been very, very informative and hopefully not too overwhelming.
Yeah, there's a lot of information.
Information out there, and your process has certainly morphed over the last few scopes of work. So it's just interesting to see that keeping your finger on the pulse of this has really paid tenfold for you, and I think having your insights as part of the demonstration project, and your close relationship from that with CMS is very, very helpful. And I think moving forward, we'd love to hear more about how your concurrent review goes using that premier product.
Yeah.
If that's an effective methodology for doing some of this data collection.
Yeah, because I think the technology had to exist in order for the process to be modified. And so Barbara is moving forward with that, she and her staff. And so hopefully we'll maximize the use and we'll leverage off of that. And I think that's an important point, is each organization has its own cultural norms. You have your own technological components and then, of course, your workforce elements. And what you want to do is figure out which pieces of this work in the setting of your organization, because I'm not sure there's a cookie-cutter approach to be adopted. It has to resonate. Our staff is highly voluntary, so we had to make certain activities occur, like the preference list, that others may not even have to think about. But you may have to think about a different set of issues. You know, so I would say try to step back and look at the whole picture, because sometimes we get so down into the detail, we lose some of the learnings.
Thank you very much. And I just want to remind everyone that next week's conference call is on Wednesday instead of Tuesday, Wednesday, September 21st from 11 to 12 noon. And Karen Nelson will be talking about approaching data abstraction and validation from a healthcare system level. And their model is a little bit different because they have a core group of folks that do data collection throughout the system. And Maureen Bueno from Robert Wood Johnson will be talking about the training and the types of abstractors they use for doing this data collection process. So we look forward to hearing from you on the next call. If you have any questions, please feel free to send them on to me, Straub, S-T-R-A-U-B, at gmyha.org, and I am happy to forward them on to the appropriate folks and get answers to you as quickly as possible. So if there are no further questions, operator, I think we'll call it a day. Thank you all.